in, you know, within that tight intimacy. And it, and the text has the, it has the Barbello, and then it has the pentad of the aeons of the father, and then it has further unfolding. So that it's not distant in the same sense that Kabbalah might talk about it, but there is a sense of there is decreasing level of intimacy. Then there's a definite breach with Sophia's creation of Yaldabaoth, and the whole realm of Yaldabaoth, the cosmos created by Yaldabaoth, is distinct from the whole realm of the Aeons, and the text is very clear on that. So I don't want to try to sort of say that it's all just one big thing. However, it is all contained within the nature of the One, because, you know, that is the fundamental theological orientation of the text, I think.
Yeah. No, that's I'm really glad that you pointed it out, because it really gets into my next rant, which is Dr. Plesha very cleverly points out that, you know, the book never says what happens. It never really says the end. We read that in, because, you know, for all we know, the material world might keep going forever. And the process of ascent and descent, which we'll also talk about, might keep going on forever. But on that topic, so the Aeonic realm before Sophia's error, which we'll talk about in a moment, because again, drawing from Dr. Plesha, he has a very interesting interpretation of it, is viewed as differentiated beings that in some ways are separate, but are within the One, right? That live together in holy harmony, as divine beings, right? That are in some ways are separate, but in some ways are united.
Yeah, distinct and differentiated, but not separate, I think. That's probably the best way to put it.
That's right. So I think a lot of people read this text, and I've read this text, that, you know, what we are, what happens to us when we die, is we lose our identities, and we get sucked into the One, not the Father. Yeah, we get sucked into the One, and then that's that, right? The process that we saw at the very beginning of the text is reversed. Everything becomes the One again. That's not there. And I actually really don't need to read the book that carefully to get an idea of what its soteriology is, what its salvation plan is, which is in some ways, and I think Christians, what we think of now as Christians, mainstream Christianity, might have actually gacked this, stolen it from the Gnostics, which is we're aeons, and we will ascend to be aeons, and that will be the rest of eternity. So in a way, it is a much more sophisticated Platonic idea of the quote-unquote boring Christian idea of heaven. The first father is sort of like the sun. Around him revolves the planets, which will be the aeons, which will be us. I know some people out there are watching this and being like, isn't that what the Mormons say? As well as the Christians, because of course we will also be as gods, we will be aeons, and the aeons are basically divinities. But the Mormons, Joseph Smith, you know, he did have some exposure to esoteric ideas. So, you know, he is getting some Gnosticism, you know, third, second, fourth hand. So yeah, so I think we are reading the text through later Christian mysticism as well, which you know is pushing back against this heaven idea. Mind you, this is still a much more sophisticated idea than heaven. But when I'm talking about how other early Christians, because we're still Christians, might have stolen this idea from the Gnostics. You know, if you read the Bible carefully, if you look at the beliefs of the early church, you know, they believed in a physical resurrection, as did many co-religionists who were Judeans and what we now call Jews, right? Is that God would resurrect us in bodies that would be perfected, right? We would never get sick, tired, old, what have you. Our dogs would come back, and we would live on this earth as perfected beings. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a much later development is this heaven idea. I think, you know, the Gnostics might have been an influence on that. Mind you, I think there's some very bad ideas of quote-unquote heaven. And of course, this is a very sophisticated, troubling, infuriating version of that, because there's even subtleties within there. So there's another read in it. And it also helps me too when I'm doing a particularly depressing reading of Gnosticism, which of course Gnosticism could already be particularly depressing, right?
Depressing, yeah.
Yes. Which is, you know, there is an underlying unity in this world. There is something that connects us all. But at the same time, there's division. And when I look around, I only see division. And when I look internally, I only experience division. And, you know, my reading of Secret John does say that division is all we can have if we want to be beings, right? And division is all we will get. But of course, we will have a much better version of it, because as you said, we are participating in something in this realm to come, in this realm that's already existing because it's outside of time, that is a different kind of division that we could ever imagine, which of course is also a unity.
It's a harmonious differentiation, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly. It's a harmonious differentiation. And what the Demiurge produces and what we live in is a non-harmonious, to say the
right,
least, differentiation. And that also brings us to, quote-unquote, Sophia's error, her fall, because I think a lot of people read the text and are quite disturbed by misogyny, right? Because, although I'll circle back to this, It basically says, to paraphrase, you know, Sophia, without the permission of her partner, without the permission of the other Aeons, tries to create. And I think a lot of people read that and say, well, you know, she needs the permission of her husband. And one, like, isn't creation always good? Isn't it great to create?
Right.
But I think it was, you know, I was asking you about this years ago, and I think you pointed out one of the messages, the reason for that, or a way that it could be interpreted, is this is what happens when we're not in harmony with others. This is what happens when we take our division, our individuality too far. When we act outside of community. So it's not necessarily about her consort and his permission, but the pushing away, the breaking away, and trying to go your own out of an almost egoic fashion, right? Because she wants to create all by herself.
Right.
And structure of the Aeonic unfolding, the permission is always asked. It's always done in unity. And the text is always really very strong while pointing that out.
That's over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. I think as always, there are choices made in translation, and the term that's getting translated permission in some translations is translated consent in other translations. Yeah. And that gives it a very different vibe. And you're quite right that as any Aeon seeks to do anything, they seek the consent of the invisible spirit, and the invisible spirit consents, and then the thing happens. And so the whole thing happens in an harmonious unity. And then Sophia is the first of the Aeons to do something that doesn't involve anybody's consent. She just undertakes an action all of her own accord. There's a couple of things that's worth pointing out. So from the point of view of the disturbing misogyny of the passage, you've got to kind of interestingly ignore a lot of things before you get to that point in order to make that interpretation. So Sophia's not a woman, first thing. She's an Aeon. So the Aeons are masculine and feminine in the sense that they're in pairs, and one pair has an active vibe and one pair has a receptive vibe, and that's the sense in which they're masculine and feminine, and this is a metaphor and blah, 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 blah. She's not a lady. But also, she's not the first feminine gendered. She's by no means, by a long stretch, not the first feminine gendered figure in the whole story up until this point. So it's not like the only depiction of a feminine figure is the one making the mistake. Also, the first depiction of a feminine gendered figure is Barbello, who is the first thought of the Invisible Father and, you know, the sort of like massively transcendent cosmic figure, you know. So I think you've kind of got to bracket out a lot of the feminine depictions that happened prior to that point in order to focus on that particular one. Also, what happens with Sophia happens in the different versions. I think a lot of scholars tend to interpret the long version of Secret John as being a little later. It's had stuff added onto it, and the shorter versions as being sort of more primordial in the history of the text. And I like that. The shorter versions, the later versions add in extra phrases to explain in more detail Sophia's error and like exactly how it happened. The shorter versions are more kind of gnomic about it.
Yeah.
So even calling it an error doesn't happen quite so clearly in the earlier texts. And we keep saying Sophia, which is interesting, right? So with wisdom, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean,
we're using a Greek term, but what the text is saying is wisdom. So the one's wisdom, right? Because if we're talking about the differentiation of various functions of the divine mind in this process of aeonic unfolding, then one of the last that is unfolded is the divine's wisdom. So the divine self-knowledge comes first, and then all these eternal qualities of the divine, and then the kind of the interior sort of kind of perfected humanity of the autogenies is formed. And then somewhere down the track, the divine's wisdom. And what is the first thing wisdom does? I mean, to be cheeky, everything up until now has been these perfectly balanced, harmonious everythings. You know, there's these stages and everything is in harmony and there's all this consent and everything's in balance and it all refers back to the perfect invisible father. And so what does God's wisdom do? Well, what's the only thing to balance all this harmony? Some disharmony.
Yeah.
So is it an error?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and I think Dr. Plesha would definitely agree that it's not. And, you know, I think the central metaphor is, you know, the book could be very very subtle, but I think this is pretty easy to pick up. And it's really funny that I started off the show with a rant about how we have to translate the aeons into English terms, and then I just go ahead and say Sophia instead of wisdom. Right. But I'm so used to it, right? Moving in Gnostic circles and such. But of course, wisdom isn't wisdom until you have lived, until you've overcome adversity. Now, this sounds like hack or cliche, but you know, it's true, right? It is the only way to become wise. It is the only way for wisdom to develop. And if you are in this harmonious relationship where there are no challenges, where there is no aging and death, then how does wisdom become wisdom?
Right.
There's
a funny thing that you know, what humanity regards as wisdom, perhaps that's the divine's foolishness, you know, as well. You know, so there's a kind of a potential duality there. And then there's a whole temple take, but we'll come back to that.
Yeah. I really like, I'm going to link it up, Dr. Zlatko Plesha's, I'm saying his name right, talk that he gave to the AJC and his awesome book, The Poetics of the Gnostic Myth. I can't remember what it's called, but it's all about Secret John. I will link it up as well. Please forgive me, Sophia. Anyways, I see this as a bit of a read-in, but in the... So I mentioned all this starts when the one seeks to know itself, right? So wisdom has no choice but to want to know the one because it is God's wisdom. But the one is unknowable. So in the Valentinian version of the Gnostic myth, this is what causes the fall, which is very interesting. Sophia seeks to know the unknown father. In this particular case, they actually use the phrase unknown father. The unknown father cannot be known. And Sophia's despair, wisdom's despair, is what creates this world, causes wisdom to fall. Dr. Plesha, and the Valentinians seem to come after this text and are probably using this text, reinterpreting this text, taking bits of this text to turn it into their myth or some version of this text. So Dr. Plesha actually does see that in here. This is what he sees starting creation, the birth of Yaldabaoth, whatever you want to see. Because it says something like, now Sophia, who is the wisdom of afterthought, who constitutes an eternal realm, conceived of a thought from herself, with the conception of the invisible spirit and foreknowledge.
Whose translation are you with?
Marvin Mayer's.
Afterthought's a really weird translation of...
Yeah. I guess that's probably pronoia. So what Dr. Plesha says is this Sophia thinking, this thought, this wanting to bring something forth is in imitation of the first father, is the thought is wanting to know the first father, right? Wanting to know the one. And then what happens is the birth of Yaldabaoth, because she cannot know the one.
Right.
In his interpretation, actually, she does know the one. She actually succeeds. Because what does she see that nobody else sees? What does she bring forth from the one through, even though it's coming from her? What is she bringing forth from the one that nobody else did, that no one else dared to do, that nobody else could do because they're doing it in harmony, right?
Right.
They're bringing forth the darkness of the one.
The misshapen, perverted monstrosity of inherent in the one. Yeah.
That's right. Exactly. And of course, you know, again, this is a psychological metaphor, because what happens when we turn inwards and experience something dark, misshapen, something that we discovered all on our own without anybody else. Oh, we cast it away. We push it away, right? Mm-hmm. So we suppress it. And that causes problems later. So I think he's on to something there.
Absolutely. There's the specificity of the exact move Sophia makes.
Yeah.
Are so bang on in terms of how psychological repression occurs in us during human development as children. So that she creates, she makes this thing, then she's repulsed by it, she's disgusted by it, so then she rejects it and pushes it away, and then she hides it, and then she pretends nothing ever happened, like a cat that tries to jump on a windowsill and misses. This entire thing was meant to happen the entire time. There's nothing to see here, you know.
Yeah. And this is the central, like what you described, what is one of the central. Yeah, it's what we do. It's one of the central insights of psychoanalysis and psychology. What basically started, you know, psychology was just what you said, right? This is how humans develop, and you know, this
repression, which is how that's how we pack us. That's how we pack the different stages of our psyche into little boxes in order to create the process of human development that brings us to adulthood. And so a text that's phrased for adults to be reading as a way of kind of saying, okay, welcome. You wind up in adulthood and it's vexing, right?
Yeah.
The saints tell us we are in fact one with the divine. And yet that's not your experience right now, is it? Let's be honest. In fact, you're not even at one with yourself. In fact, you're deeply divided. You're a mess. What's up with that? How did that come about? How could that have possibly come about? How can you not even know yourself properly? Right? It's not a matter of intellectual reflection, this coming to know yourself. There's something else. There's other things going on. It's complex, actually.
Yeah.
How do we account for this complexity? By painting a picture of the divine that's just as complex as your actual situation. I've never seen an ancient text that does as good a job of painting the complexity of the human psyche as Secret John.
Yeah, yep, I agree. And for that instance, modern texts. I've seen there are more, but I've seen few modern texts.
Right. Like I feel like with every passing decade, we look back at Secret John and go, oh, you actually had that on lock already. Oh, okay, right. Yeah, cool. Okay, good. Yeah.
No, it's incredibly insightful, and you know, I can't. you know, there's definitely no, I mean, I don't know if there's any text in the first couple till at least, I can't think of any text. I can't think of any text that's contemporary or, you know, up until Freud that has these kinds of insights. So, and you know, it's fairly obvious. I don't think it's a read-in, right? Like it's you know, it's right there. The other thing as well, you know, to have our cake and eat it too, for a double metaphor, is then something else that, you know, even first time, second time readers of the text pick up is when talking about human development, to get it a little bit more literal than instead of just happening inside of a head, which is, you know, what happens to a child that you don't like or didn't want to have, or for some reason see as inferior and you push it away, how is it going to develop, right? What happens if you don't bring a child into community? You know, I think that is a very powerful metaphor that is also in the text, because, you know, if Sophia had, if Wisdom had given birth to this misshapen thing and then said, well, okay, you know,
might be ugly, but it's mine.
Yeah. Come and meet the other Aeons.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you spend 15 minutes reading about modern attachment theory and then read that narrative, it's like, whoa, that's rough. So deeply heretical take on the whole Jesus story, because the Gospel of John says was in the beginning with God and nothing was created without him, and the creator is the demiurge. So deeply heretical take is that Jesus is the physical human incarnation of Yaldabaoth.
Yeah.
We need to keep going. The physical incarnation of Yaldabaoth, and he's given physical form because spiritual realities are eternal. They don't change, right? Yeah. Change is only possible in the human realm. So the Yaldabaoth is incarnated as Jesus to a loving human mother to repair his attachment wound, because it can't be repaired in the cosmic order. It can only be repaired in a human being. It's repaired in the life of Jesus, who then ascends, and that's the beginning of the process of cosmic repair.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that interpretation, it jives quite well with the text.
I don't think anybody else has ever had a go at that, and I don't like the term heretic. I say cheeky. I think it's a cheeky interpretation of the text. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, Irenaeus says that the Cephians, his version of the Cephian myth is actually different than what's in this text, but there's strong similarities. But then he goes on, right? Because we never, you know, this basically ends at it ends at Noah, right? So so it doesn't continue. But Irenaeus says something like really weird when he's talking about the Cephians, like they believed that the demiurge created Jesus and that Jesus was his son. But I believe that an Aeon then comes down and fuses with the Demiurge's son. It's not really clear, but it is clear that Jesus is at least partly of the Demiurge, more than just in the same way that we are, right? That we have the counterfeit spirit, that we partake of, some of us have the counterfeit spirit, or we partake of materiality. Then he says something very interesting, that Jesus ascends and rules on the right hand of the Demiurge. So kind of I believe as a positive, kind of like tempering the Demiurge's rule of the world, I think is the insinuation, is like Jesus doesn't go back to the realm of the Aeons, but isn't in control of this world. And it's just like, hey, stepdad, semi-dad, maybe let's not have another flood. Let's go a little bit easier on them. I'm going to send another prophet. So, very the very fascinating stuff. Okay, so I mean, in some ways, this is sort of the. We're not going to go through the whole text. I mean, we still are at the very beginning, but of course, as you said off air, that would be at least a 15-hour series. I doubt it would be a 15-hour series. It would probably be a lifetime series. We would just die on air if we tried to go through the entire text, you know, chapter by chapter, verse by verse.
We could hypothetically, at the end of the show, suggest that if people wanted to be in a study group around Secret John, that maybe that might be a Gnostic Wisdom Network thing that might happen at some point in the future, and they should mention that they're interested somewhere
if they express interest in the YouTube comments or email me, jonathan@gnosticwisdom.net, I bet you that's something we could get going. So, but in some ways, we are kind of talking about some of the misconceptions that we see about this text, right? And one of the misconceptions might be, you know, Sophia Wisdom as the central character, as the main character, as the quote-unquote divine feminine. What's your take on that?
I don't know if anybody does actually read Secret John and make that interpretation. Sophia gets a lot of press amongst modern Gnostics, and a lot of people, when they are looking for a feminine divine figure, they look to Sophia. And I think a lot of that is historical. I think it's because some of the earliest Gnostic material we had was Pista Sophia, and that, I think which I've never read. But, you know, the Theosophists loved it, above. And it has a sense of the kind of the higher Sophia and the lower Sophia, I think, and has Sophia functioning as a much more salvific figure. I'd argue it's late and probably draws on Valentinian material, because Valentinus has the Sophia Achamoth is the lower Sophia, and then he has, what's the higher one called?
I can't remember, but Sophia? I suppose it might just be Sophia.
It all gets sort of smushed into this Sophia figure in the later material, and it doesn't in Secret John. There's distinct figures that are gendered feminine in the text, and they've all got distinct functions, and it's actually a lot clearer. And I think it would serve people to understand that a little better. So primarily, like, the OG who does all the work is Barbello. Who's called Pronoia in some other texts. There's another Sethian text called Trimorphic Protenoia. The three forms of the first thought is sometimes translated that way. Same figure. So Pronoia, Protenoia, Barbello are the same initial thought of the invisible spirit figure. And that's who kind of creates as a faithful reflection of herself this Epinoia figure, and the Epinoia figure is the one who comes down into the garden and teaches Adam and Eve and creates the possibility of salvation for them from their kind of benighted state. It's implied in Trimorphic Protenoia that she goes on to manifest multiple times through human history as different figures, and the last of whom is debatably Jesus or John the Baptist or somebody, right? So, summary, Gnostics need to spend a lot less time talking about Sophia and a lot more time talking about Pronoia, in my view, because that's you read the Pronoia hymn in Secret John, you read the aratological, the sort of self-statement material that Protenoia makes in Trimorphic Protenoia, and the language is so similar to what you read in Thunder Perfect Mind. It makes I think it's a very compelling argument that Thunder Perfect Mind is a very long version of those same self-statements that you see in the Sethian material. That's why it's often classified as part of the Sethian corpus. We can do a whole other show on Thunder Perfect Mind. That's that's for a later time. But that's the transcendent, the transcendent feminine figure par excellence, right? Yeah. Sophia's the benighted feminine, if you like, and you know, worth understanding and for men and women to kind of, you know, inhale the human reality of that. But if you're looking for a divine feminine, Pronoia is the divine feminine. She is the great lady.
Yeah. again, not to harp on my point of us becoming aeons, becoming united to the aeons, but we don't get sucked up into the one, right? But near the beginning, there is.
I dispute we become aeons. It's a supportable, and I get it. I wouldn't dispute it. I'd offer an alternative, but keep going.
Okay. Near the beginning, when it's talking about some of the different aeons and stuff, there's, and in the fourth aeon were placed the souls who did not understand their perfection, yet they did not repent immediately, but they persisted a while. In the end, however, they repented. They will remain in the fourth light, Eliath, the one who yoked them to himself, glorifying the invisible spirit. having been gathered to that place, glorifying the invisible spirit. Now, this is very confusing because this passage is before creation, right? So who are these repentant souls? And Dr. Plesha points out that, oh, well, like, even before, quote-unquote, wisdom's error, before the fall, before human creation, you know, this takes place before that, meaning that somebody knows it's going to happen. And also, that's where the repentant souls will go, where forever they will glorify the invisible spirit. It's actually a little bit confusing, too, about who the repentant souls are, if that's just every soul that finds gnosis, or if that is, you know, somebody who needs to repent. But that is reiterated later. So later on, they mentioned, you know, where the souls go, and they mentioned Eliyahu again. Also, yeah. Sorry, at the beginning, when John is pondering, he says, "And of what sort is that aeon to which we will go?" He told us that the aeon is modeled on that indestructible aeon, but he did not teach us what sort the latter is. Which also sort of indicates that we become united with some sort of aeon, probably Eliyahu.
I mean, this is Eliyahu is one of the four luminaries who surround Autogenes Christ.
Yeah.
In the divine unfolding. And each of those four luminaries gathers some souls to themselves.
Yeah.
So the unrepentant ones go to Eliyahu, to the fourth, but then the other three also, you know, at various levels of sainthood, you wind up in one of the other four luminaries as the aeon that you is your home. I guess
the aeons are also called realms, and of course aeon is a duration of time, so it's like, but of course it's not meant to be time because there is no time, but it's, you know, it is trying to conceive of the text seems to be indicating something that is a being, an entity, a god that is also
an age and a place,
yeah,
and also possibly a people. That sometimes it's called it refers to races or ethnos, I think, in Greek. So there's some sense in which it's a people as well. So yeah, smushy, yeah. Smushy. The ancient mind, everything joins up. less of this distinct separateness that we're so obsessed with in the modern era.
Also, something that I never really noticed in the text before. Do you notice that aeons descend upon us? And that's an important part of salvation? Because unfortunately, yeah. It's near the end. It's like it's a counter to the counterfeit spirit. Unfortunately, the translation that I was reading used realms, but it's Dr. Plesha that pointed it out in his talk, and it's like two quick passages. So it might be the same as the spirit of life, because it seems that the soteriology of Secret John is, you know, you strive for gnosis. Whatever you do not backslide, because it has some very strong, if you start on this path and you backslide, it has some very strong language for you. And then at some point, the spirit of truth, the spirit of life will descend upon you. And also an aeon will descend upon you.
Right, yes.
Or the aeon might also be the spirit of life. But it's very unclear. But to make a long story short, the text says that aeons will descend upon you. Dr. Plesha
you see versions of that reflected through subsequent esoteric teaching for a couple of thousand years afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. And Dr. Plesha ties that into this idea of, well, you know, the materiality can't be saved, right? So what is some of the point of this? Yes, there is that spark of Sophia, which, you know, it seems like throwing an aeon in there to descend upon you almost seems like overkill, right? So why is this process happening? And his contention is this is part of the wisdom of God. This is part of God knowing itself. The aeons have to descend into materiality so that they can experience everything, so they can have more wholeness.
Right. I mean, I think this goes to some of what was coming up for me before when you were when I said I'd just dispute your interpretation. I'd correct that. I'm not going to dispute your interpretation. I think there's something that's kind of pointed to implicitly in the text, not explicitly, right?
Yeah.
The formation of Adam, and I'm, you know, tactically not saying Adam, like Adam, right? To kind of make it seem a little bit unfamiliar. The creation of Adam is a parody of the creation of autogenes, right? Yes. So the aeonic version of the human is the perfected version of the human, and what Yaldabaoth creates and the Archons create is well, the best they could do given the circumstances, right? And into that is breathed the spirit of Sophia, which is ultimately the breath of the invisible spirit descended through the aeons, through the matched pairs of aeons, through Sophia into Yaldabaoth and then into Adam and also into Eve, the mother of the living, and hence into us, right? But so what do we get handed? Like, what are we handed as human beings? So what's this humanness that we're handed? So it's materiality, which is described as chaos, or Nothikrasi, the mother of chaos, is the mother of the matter. And it takes a sort of more or less what we'd recognize from Neoplatonism is matter is just confused. Yeah. It's a muddle. Everything's kind of mixed up. There's no clarity to it, you know?
So what you're saying is, just to clarify, and with a careful reading of this text, I think I can back this up, is matter is evil and so are bodies. would that be a good summation of what you're saying? Because that's what the text says, right?
It's absolutely not what the text says. Nice digression. Good marginal note. It's absolutely not what the text says. No, it actually says very little about matter. The vast bulk of what the text talks about in the creation of the human being is the creation of the human soul, or the soul body. And it goes to some, it's confusing because it goes into extensive detail about the left testicle and the right testicle of the soul body. And this is on the long version of Secret John. The left ear and the right ear, the various kidneys of the soul body and the withers and loins and so on of the soul body. So it goes into extensive anatomical detail of the soul body, but it's talking about a soul body. It's not talking about a physical body. And having gone to all this painstaking construction of the modern post-theosophical parlance, you might say the astral body or the etheric body, perhaps, is cast into matter. So the very final stage is, well, so there's matter, and matter's confused and weird and chaotic and difficult to make sense of, and there are archons that oversee it and whatever. But it's not particularly evil.
Yeah.
The text doesn't paint it as particularly evil or as a particular problem, except that it's confusing and yes. muddled. So the soul body's placed kind of like as the final step. It's kind of like, okay, and as if that wasn't bad enough, we're going to put you in this confusing materiality, which is just going to be... I think the most accurate way to phrase it is it's distracting.
Yes.
Materiality is very distracting. Yeah. But it's not fundamentally the problem. The text goes to great lengths to explain that fundamentally the problem is the human psyche.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which means like soul, the human soul, the psyche, our interior experience of our interior self alienation and fragmentation.
Yeah. I mean, just compare how many times the text talks about the body with the counterfeit spirit and fate. Like, you know, those are, and as you said, you know, what the division of the human being due to the counterfeit spirit. Like, right. that's what the text is really obsessed about. And that's really what it says is the problem. Now it does say that the body is a prison. It does mention the cave at least three times. It's getting that straight from Plato. Plato said the body is a prison,
right?
Like, I actually find, like, yeah, okay, the text...
It's peculiarly Gnostic. It's everyone. Everyone.
It's everyone. And yeah. In some ways, not only is it everyone, you know, I would say that this text is a little less extreme than most of its contemporaries. Now, you know, does it sync up, 1,000% with modern body positivity? You know, maybe not. But probably. You know, compare it to the Platonists, compare it to Paul, compare it to many other forms of Christianity, both then and now. It's you know, the body is not the problem in comparison.
It's anti-cosmic, but you've got to understand what the cosmos is, and the cosmos is the system of fate which is intertwined with the fragmentation of the human mind, and it's the fragmentation of the human mind that's the fundamental thing we're committed to overcoming. And it's the, you know, as you know, if you spent 15 or 20 seconds trying to, you know, notice what's happening in your mind, if you've made the terrible mistake of trying to undertake a meditation practice at some point in your life, you may have noticed.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've said this on the show. I've definitely said it to you. If you want to know the archons, if you want to know the reality of the rulers, to quote the title of a Gnostic text, then sit down and meditate for 5 minutes. You'll meet them pretty quick. Yeah,
we'll just go into social life and hang around other human beings because they show up all around you. Or are they? You know, like, not so much. So just to kind of come back and round off the thing I was trying to say before. So the reality of our situation, right? To come back to kind of like, hey, welcome to adult life. I think we're supposed to be in union with the divine, but that doesn't seem to be the current situation. What actually is the current situation? So the picture that we're painted from the text is, okay, so like we're deeply fragmented in our internal life.
Yeah.
We're riven by impulses and thought streams and feelings and emotions that to come from nowhere. We have no adequate account to give of them. We somewhere in the core of us, we feel intuitively, and the saints assure us this is the case, there is the very breath of the divine in the heart of the human being, and that can tell that's there, but it's almost impossible to be with or to notice or to realize. And to make matters worse, we're placed in material reality, which is constantly trying to attract our attention and is confusing us all the time and is constantly demanding our attention and awareness. So any attempt to draw our awareness in to focus on the issues of self-alienation and fragmentation that we need to really be focusing on in order to realize that inner divine nature is fraught, because we've got to handle the problem of materiality. What are we supposed to do? So the problem that we're set in the text is that's our situation. But that situation, so the interesting thing is that setup is an attempt to recreate the perfect human. That's the image of the perfect human.
Yes.
Which St. Paul assures us one day we will see face to face, but right now we're only seeing through a glass, and that darkly, you know.
Yes.
So that this healing of this fragmentation and self-alienation project that we have to undertake results in some more faithful image of that divine human that was presented to our creator.
Yeah.
That's what enables us to kind of take our place amongst the luminaries, you know, circling as part of the divine realm. So other things, too many other things.
yeah No, I definitely agree on that, and I think that's exactly what it's saying. And you know, I would say, drawing on some of the more political readings of the text, or there's a really great book called off air, we often joke about, okay, so I've talked about this in the show before, you know, the Gnostic greeting, the secret handshake of Gnostics, the secret greeting is, have you read, right? Because there's always another book to read. Wrestling with Archons by Jonathan Gahanna Bloom. It's less than 200 pages. It's a relatively quick read. I think it's a build out of his PhD thesis, probably. But, you know, he says, I don't, you know, 100% buy this thesis, but I'm going to say I buy this thesis because I'm using it in my thesis for school. So it is 100% correct, which is the Gnostics were the first to do critical theory. You know,
okay.
a phrase that is that has been in the news lately. They are doing critical philosophy, critical theory, comparable to what was going on in the 20th and 21st century. But they can only use the language and concepts that they have, right? Which are religious languages and concepts. So when we're talking about what is the matter of the human condition, is we have this internal thing. We are divided beings, right? Everything that you just talked about, but all the fate stuff, as well as the bad rulership of the world by the Demiurge, who is, you know, also probably the Emperor of Rome. Archon just means ruler. The modern equivalent would be something like mayor or congressperson, right? Because Archon is literally what you called the guy who ruled your town, county,
whatever. I think if you're in a Greek Orthodox parish, then the Archons are the parish councillors, actually.
Oh yeah. It's a very common term, but it's in that context. Then it would have been, you know, like if I wrote the text now, you know, the Demiurge would be president and Archons would be Congress people. That's how it would be for ancient people. They would see the word Archon and they would immediately know who you're talking about. You're talking about your local ruler. So you know, his contention is that that it is two things, right? It is this internal division, but it is the oppressive world system that we live in, right? That is badly run. And when the Gnostics were talking about fate, they are also partly talking about that world system, right? When they're talking about the Archons, they're also partly talking about that world system. But of course, you know, it does work. You know, it sounds like I'm contradicting myself, but of course, the writer of this text did mean it on those levels, right? They meant it internally. You know, the Archons are in here. They meant it externally. And actually, modern secular people would say that as well. If you're a political person who leans left, trying not to get in trouble, then, you know, there's false consciousness, right? Which means that there are these external forces of control, but they get into your brain.
I'd argue it goes both ways. Like, I mean, if you've worked in an organization of any kind, a church, company, scout troop, whatever, you know, we're all walking around in self-alienation. We're all walking around with repressed psychological material that, you know, we're not handling consciously, which we tend to go through psychological processes of projection and introjection around. We don't handle very well. We get triggered all over the place. We have feelings we can't account for. And we deal with those as though we're in a family again. If you've worked in an organization, you've watched people, you know, come up with fantastic stories about each other that are really about the denied aspects of themselves. And, you know, you put three people together in a room where if two or more are gathered together, it's about time to undertake some psychological projection, as I think Jesus said. I may be misquoting. So you just watch that in a little group of three people, you know, where, you know, like two of them decide they don't like the third one and start having a kind of a side conversation. This is politics in its most atomistic frame. And those political maneuvers are driven by our own psychological fragmentation. So the psychological fragmentation exteriorizes itself as a political reality, which gradually becomes an en masse political reality. And then we see our own fragmentation confirmed in the political reality that's handed back to us. And so the whole thing's in a kind of a self-reinforcing cycle. So it's not, there's no distinction really even going on here. There's absolutely no separateness between what goes on in us psychologically and what goes on in our societies politically, right? I mean, yes. We all, those of us that live in alleged democracies are generally living in two-party states where there's literally two parts to the political mind, which is at war with each other, and which from the outside, it's very difficult to sometimes tell the difference between.
Yeah,
it reviles the other as the denied shadow, you know, like it's hilarious.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Okay, what else do we have on our secret list of misconceptions?
And not so secret list of misconceptions. Hang on. Yeah. What have I done with mine? I had it and then I have lost it. Hang on. It's just here. Wait a second.
Well, while you're taking it up, this only recently occurred to me, and I'm really sorry, Tony. But Gnostic assent isn't in the text.
It's not. That's fair. We are through the topics we said we'd talk about. That's true. It's not directly. I mean, it's kind of implied because there's sort of a descent process that gets us to where we are. Yeah. So it's not crazy to imagine that that's painting a picture of kind of ascent back.
Well, that's how it works in other texts, right? Like, for sure. But we're saved by the descent of the Aeon, or by the spirit of truth. That's the soteriology.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. The guidance of Epinoia, I think.
Yeah.
Who is the antidote to the counterfeit spirit. That's not super clear, but I think it's a supportable kind of interpretation. The guidance of Epinoia, or as we'd call her in the modern era, the Holy Spirit, I think. I don't think that's a big stretch. The Holy Spirit's not Sophia. That's not a question. I think when you read what the role of Epinoia is in the text, and then you read how, particularly in the Orthodox Church, they talk about the Holy Spirit, it's the same deal. Like, it's the same, it's soteriologically the same figure. Yeah, it's the guidance of the Holy Spirit, and then gradually it's the unification of the kind of conventional mind with the mind of Christ. In other words, the Aeon descending upon the human being and the two becoming into union. That gets framed different ways in different eras of Christian history and different various denominational schisms and whatever, but it's basically that's the process.
Yeah, and I think that's the process in here too. Now, not to say that other texts don't have a Gnostic ascent, and Gnostic ascent isn't very important. I guess you can read it in as, because I think the soteriology is you have to do things that get you gnosis. You have to work towards gnosis.
Yeah, and I think I
which
think
would be not... Gnostic ascent would be the, well, but where are you ascending to? Because when you die, you're only going to end up in Elia for one of those other four luminaries.
Yeah, framing it as ascent. Well, what I think is implicit in the text, and perhaps not super clear, is that it makes a big production number about how we're all bound by fate.
Yes.
And when they say fate, they mean astrology, really. They mean we're bound by the influence of the planets on our human soul. There's a lot of there's a big production number about the archons that rule, the rulers of the planets. And there's a piece about how they've got their kind of like their name that gives them power and their name that disempowers them.
Yep.
So each of them has two names. And if you know the name that disempowers them, that this is implied, but perhaps not clearly stated. If you use the name that disempowers them, if you know them by that name, that weakens the influence of that planet on your psyche, which is partly what brings the human psyche back into balance. So it's that's the same thing that a planetary ascent.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Specifically. Yeah.
Like if you're undertaking, like the Aurum Solis material or the rituals of planetary ascent, they're partly about kind of coming into a direct relationship with each of the planetary, the Olympic planetary spirits or the planetary angels or whatever. And that interaction with the planetary spirit is meant to be kind of harmonizing and balancing out the influence of the planet in your psyche. And that brings you closer to your genius or your holy guardian angel or divine union. And, that's what kind of creates in Secret John terms, that's what kind of opens the capacity for the psyche to allow the descent of the Aeon. So it's an ascent process in other traditions. I think it's not, I think it is fair to say that specific bit of it isn't really necessarily an ascent process as it's phrased here, but it does talk about an ascent process. There's the human souls, freeing Sophia so that Sophia can ascend, and return to the realm of the Aeons. We're leaving the realm of the Demiurge and moving. It never really frames these as up and down exactly, but we're kind of ascending into the realm of the four luminaries. There's ascending going on, but it's all, as with everything in Secret John, it's complex and there's multiple places and it doesn't all kind of, there's plot holes that you could drive a truck through and it's all a bit complicated and weird.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Sorry, Tony, wherever you are, if you're watching this, you better be.
You're deeply wrong, but also very right.
Yeah, no, that is a good point. Although that's very subtle, and it's like, and of course, Gnostic ascent is still like, I think you can see it more clear in some of the other texts. But even then, of course, it is subtle. It's never laid out because it was probably a quote unquote secret technology, right?
Apart from, so, Gospel of Mary. Yes. It's pretty explicit, I think. Yeah, that's probably the main one, but yeah.
Yeah, but you're right, the double names does indicate that. And that's more explicit in, say, the Corpus Hermeticum, where it's like, there's some of the texts that are very like, okay, the planet gives you this, that's bad, and you need to get rid of that. So it's got a list of what it would, the seven bad qualities, which of course later become, in the Christian tradition, the seven deadly sins, and you need to cast those off. How do you cast off? How do you cast it off? Well, you ascend past that planet, and once you're outside of its influence, you no longer have that quality in yourself. So it is very explicit there. But you're right. Yeah, the fascinating thing about the double, is that the sequence with the double name thing, where all the names that are known are like good things, because there's another Sophia, like one of the I'm assuming it's because the Archons are made in the image of the Aeons, or parodies of the Aeons. There's like a sequence that's like, well, they have this public name, and then they have a secret name, and the public name is all good stuff, right? It's stuff like wisdom, life, what have you, which of course is also meant to be the conception about Gnosticism as a parody of religion, which a lot of people turned away from, or is an interrogation of religion, or a way of understanding religion, not just Christianity and Judaism, religion in general, I think is spot on. And that's what's going on there, because it's like, oh, okay, well, you think this thing is wisdom, you think this thing is life, you think this thing is spirit, you think this thing is good. Well, actually, it's bad. And actually, that's if you do, it's a bad thing, and it's tricking you. And if you knew its secret name,
then you'd actually know. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Hey, temple theology. You probably don't have anything to say about that.
Well, I mean, I think what's eye-catching about... Before we get to temple theology, I did just want to say, I think this is... To come back to the thing of, like, this text is life, but also it's trash. And I think that deep ambivalence is really crucial. There's a tendency, particularly if you've come from a Protestant background, but I think for most Christians, because of the way scripture's treated, like the literal word of God, and you have to spend all your time desperately trying to understand what it's trying to tell you so that you can, you know, like, what is God speaking to me through the text? I have to understand all the things, which reaches its kind of like nadir, if I can say, in some strains of Protestantism, where the Bible's treated like a car manual, you know, like where you read that, like, okay, it says that there, so that's what I've got to go do because it says it, right? It's like, which is just it's terrible. It's a terrible misuse of scripture. That's the way scripture's been used and interpreted in Christian tradition for quite a long time. Well, so, yeah, quite a long time. It's a very Protestant thing because, you know, prior to that, nobody read it. It's Gutenberg that gave anybody the ability to actually read the Bible. Prior to that, you read it if you're a priest or a monk, but if you're an ordinary person, you didn't have access to it. You got readings in church. It was told to you, you know. Yep. It wasn't, you know, ordinary people didn't read the Bible as a way to understand anything in particular because you simply couldn't. It's crazy talk.
Yep.
Regardless of that, that's a Christian predisposition. That's not what's going on in this text. And I think it's helpful to look at the text not in its, like, in the details of it and in what it proposes you might set out to do. It may just be wrong, like, in the broad brushstrokes and the ways it reflects back the reality of you as a human being, I think it's really quite correct. So it's worth understanding in a detailed way in the sense at which it seems to be telling you the truth, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to slavishly obey every single thing it claims about your afterlife, what spiritual practice might look like, how you might go about resolving the issue. That's like a bunch of people had some ideas, and people had crazy ideas back then. Like,
yes.
Or ideas that I think we wouldn't necessarily agree with in the present day. You name checked the seven deadly sins before. Like one of the other touchstones for that is the eight logismoi of Evagrius of Pontus, the great desert father, who's just luminous in terms of his psychological grasp of the various things afflicting the mind of a monk desperately trying to pray. But his, you know, and he listed these sort of eight logismoi, these kind of like troubling thoughts that afflict your mind if you, and we're all familiar with them. If you sit down and try to meditate, you know, there's a predictable range of things that happen. You're hungry, you know, you might just be a bit listless and not able to concentrate.
Sorry to interrupt, but I didn't understand why all these monks like Saint Anthony, what have you, were so obsessed with sex and sexual temptation until I went on a 10-day meditation retreat.
100%.
I was shocked.
You only get one meal a day.
Yeah.
So gluttony comes up and you're not allowed to touch anybody or speak to anyone. And so sexual desire comes up and vainglory is like great. Like he talks about like the monk being taken up with the fantasy of being acclaimed as a bishop by the people and carried off by beautiful maidens to be made into a bishop of the church, you know, and these fantasies of like fame and glory kind of coming into the head. So all these things happen, right? Like it's complete. Yeah. And they're troubling thoughts that occur when attempting serious spiritual practice, to be clear. They're not sins in the sense. That goes on to, that goes through John Cassian to Europe, and then it goes to Gregory the Great, and Gregory the Great kind of takes those ideas and smushes them with the Hermetic tradition, and they become the seven deadly sins, which are things people do, not thoughts people might have. And it has its own vexed history in European Christianity. But Evagrius is... remedy for these thoughts was to shout psalms at them. So there's a whole book where he recommends which psalm to shout at which thought. That was his remedy for what to do about it, which I guess I haven't really tried it. Perhaps it might work. I don't really know. I suppose distract your mind with the kind of thought that you're meant to be speaking is not a bad approach, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend that, you know, if you're troubled by troubling thoughts that you start shouting psalms at your thoughts necessarily. It's probably not a goer for most people. So sorry, massive digression by way of saying, I'm not necessarily sure the prescriptions that might've been given to people about how to undertake this work at that time is necessarily the same thing that one might undertake in the present day. Because in terms of like dealing with self-alienation and psychic fragmentation, that we have a lot more tools in the toolkit now than perhaps they did back then. Some of the modern tools of psychotherapy and self-therapy and, you know, 12-step groups and addiction recovery and stuff has some really lovely tools and so on.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm glad you gave that clarification. It goes back to the clarification at the very beginning that I was talking about, right? That it's not only how we read religious texts, but I think it's how we should read religious texts. And sometimes when we're, you know, I wanted to do the show just to kind of take the text on its own terms, right? But then we can throw it in the garbage. You know, once we figure out what those terms are. And that has been a criticism, and I'm sure probably still is a criticism of our particular community, right? Of the Apostolic Johannite Church, is that, oh, well, you know, they're not actually Gnostics. You know, they bring in all this, they smush together a bunch of different texts, and they don't even, you know, follow exactly what the Cephians said, and yada, yada. And it's like, well, we've never claimed to. Yeah. And one, that would be insane. It's not the second century. Like that's crazy talk. And three, I'm not the only person that believes this. There are serious scholars that believe it as well. I think anybody who reads the text, it's pretty easy to pick up. These were written as myths. You know, like obviously they're Plato fanboys. Plato talked about the importance of myth, of creating good myths instead of bad myths. He also talks about myths he doesn't like. You know, this was created as a myth, as mythology. Right. And we should treat it as such. And we should adapt it for our modern day. And we should read it with some other things. And we should also, you know, at the same time, you can't go through life without developing perhaps some serious mental problems, and you can't go on a spiritual path if you're too open, right? You have to have some guidance, you have to have some beliefs, you have to have something. But, you know, I mean, if you get too tight on anything, well, that's not going to be very helpful. I'm kind of resorting to cliches. this probably seems very obvious to a lot of our audience, but it's deeply true. Just like, you know, this book, yeah, I think one of the central messages it has, and which is also a cliche, is that you have to live, and you have to live in the material realm. For wisdom to grow, for divinity to fix itself, for divinity to come back together. You know, that's what I really see. Like, for us all being messed up in the head, right? I think a lot of times when Gnostics and people interested in Gnosticism and related traditions, they talk about the human as divine, right? That's a very important point for a lot of people. I see this as a text that really emphasizes that. However, I read it as saying, you know, the human is divine and the divine is human, because the divine's a little screwed up and it's working through some stuff. Like, just like what you're talking about, like, you know, obviously the primal man is more perfect than us, but maybe everything's not that perfect in the Aeonic realm, as we talked about. Well, by definition, it can't be. By the logic of this book, by the rules of this book, the Aeonic realm can't be perfect.
The divine went insane.
Yeah, the divine went insane. I can't remember who said it. I think it was Eric Davis, but, you know, Gnosticism is the story about how God had a mental breakdown, became us, and how we can reverse the process.
That's how I'm putting it. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. So, yeah, but I think too, when we understand that we're screwed up because God is screwed up, we want to strive to be something more than what we are, but we often become more than what we are by understanding who we are and what we are, and by accepting what we are and what we think is darkness, right? Which I think we can also read into this text. You know, I think the text does suggest that. And I really hate, I've always been drawn to Gnosticism because I think it does take suffering seriously. And I think the text is saying something more deliberate and more deep then the material realm is here for us to learn. I know that's what it sounds like I've been saying. Because I've never liked that, because it's like, you know, the children whose eyes are being eaten by parasites, like they don't need to be sent to this realm to learn that. But I think, and maybe there isn't much of a difference, that this process is inevitable, and this is the only way that the divine can have a kind of wholeness and know itself. So it's neither good nor bad. It's not that we've been sent here to learn or the divine created the world to learn, but it is an inevitable process that began when the one looked into that water. Right. And the process ends, perhaps not in perfection, but in, you know, something better than this. That holy division that I was talking about 2 hours ago. That's my take. You know, take that with a grain of salt. That also goes into my more depressing take on Gnosticism.
It gives you I mean, it gives you a kind of interesting theodicy, right? Like, it's an interesting kind of attempt to, you know, in mainstream Christianity, they talk about the problem of evil a great deal. That in the whole of Gnosticism is one way to address that issue. Yeah. How can God be like omnipotent, all powerful, and benevolent, and also behold the world? Right. Like, what's going on with that? Because children get their eyes eaten by parasites, etc. Right.
Yeah.
All sorts of bad stuff happens in this world that we're told God created. God's all powerful and can see it all, and is apparently benevolent. How does that all work? Gnosticism in general says, well, you got to understand, there's the God that created the place, and there's the benevolent, perfect God. But I think at its peak, I think Secret John's not even saying that the monad is benevolent, even.
No.
The monad is simply whole.
Yes.
That's it. And within that, frankly, God's kind of insane and self-alienated as well. And the world that we're in is the result of that fact. The human beings that we are is the result of that fact. And yeah, all we can do is take our little part of trying to heal that fragmentation, reweave some wholeness, and, you know, be part of one little step to kind of make the whole more whole, I guess.